You are listening to the Murdoch Charitable Trust's 2017 Leadership Advance Conference, Telling the Story, Telling Your Story. The fourth general session was led by Andy Crouch of the John Templeton Foundation.
We'll begin this session with the third place winner in the Ignite Film Showcase. We've seen two examples of really remarkable storytelling, quite different from each other, and this one is different yet again. In some ways, the most conventional in a certain sense of how it tells the story of the three, and in another way, incredibly out of the box and quite stunning in the way that it tells its story. And after we watch it, I'll have a chance to have a conversation. Not this time with the filmmaker, but actually the person who supervised and taught the filmmaker, Craig Duttweiler. So this film is called Night Lights. Let's cut our house lights and watch the film Night Lights. Craig, you were executive producer on that film. What the heck does that mean, by the way, executive producer?
That means that I took 24 Pepperdine students to Australia to make this movie. That's what that means. I working in the film business, you notice there's more and more international co-productions. And Hollywood's biggest stars in some cases are Australians, you know, from Nicole Kidman to Russell Crowe. And so if I'm going to prepare students to tell stories, they need to understand that they're going to have partners and financing from all around the world. And so the International Screen Academy is a film school in Australia, in Sydney, that was started by Christians who believe in the power of story and are trying to raise up a generation. So I said, well, let's bring our young filmmakers to their young actors. And so it's the crew was all, was nine women and one gentleman from Pepperdine. And then the cast, of course, were all Australian.
Wow. I thought it might be really useful to talk for a couple of minutes about how you develop storytelling talent. I'm thinking that almost everyone here, either directly or indirectly, is going to employ people whose a particular passion and calling is storytelling. But it is probably not the particular passion and calling, like, or the number one thing that most of us get to do, at least. I mean, our jobs are more complex, perhaps. So you have spent a big chunk of your life developing people like this filmmaker. So tell us about kind of what it takes or what you do to work with someone like this. Tell us her name. It's
Isabella Issa. She's Lebanese, but she was born and raised in Jamaica.
Wow.
So she speaks with a Jamaican accent. So she's a very unique human.
Right.
And she would have been here, but this film did so well that both she and the editor just enrolled at American Film Institute, which is one of the top three film schools in the world, and the film was strong enough to get them in there. So so that's why she couldn't be here today.
That's a good excuse. All right,
we'll settle
for you.
Yeah.
And talk about how you develop someone who obviously comes in with a certain amount of talent, maybe with a story that has some promise. But I'm sure you have moments where you help them grow. What do you do?
Sure. What's interesting, Picasso said that every child is an artist, but the problem is how to remain an artist when we grow up. So I sort of believe that everybody in your organization has creative capacity, but they may not be in touch with it. So what I do with students is help them, you know, get reintegrated with that God-given gift. Yeah. So for me, it's really three steps that actually mirror the production process. So in the pre-production stage, you want to raise the standards of excellence to crazy aspirational levels. Like before you even start, it's like, this is going to be the greatest thing ever. And let them dream and let them be boundless in their imagination. And so in challenging them to go to Australia, I was like, you might want to tell an Australian story. So the screenwriter, who's from Colorado, just looked into Aboriginal myths, and she came up with this story, right? She's never been to Australia. She wrote this before she got there, but it's based in Aboriginal storytelling.
So I think it's very significant that your job was to kind of expand this possibility space they were operating in and kind of raise the level of expectation Like, this can be better than you imagine. That is really powerful. And I think it's something, if you hadn't done that, I wonder, you know, people will sort of follow their own imagination so far.
But Easy way out, or path of least resistance. Wow. So pre-production is boundless horizons. Step two, it was invitation to succeed, right? Yeah. Invitation to succeed is step one. Step two is permission to fail. Permission to fail. And that's when you're in production, what you have to do is create a safe space. You think about those actors. How vulnerable did those actors have to be? For how long? For how many days? So you have to create a very safe space. How about for a young boy, right, who's playing, acting as if they're his parents, right? You have to create a very safe space for people to take risks. So the permission to fail is rooted in the ability to take risks. So that's the production phase.
Can you say just another word? Like, in this specific production, what's something you had to do very concretely to create that sense of permission or safety? Remember?
we're showing up in a forest in Sydney, Australia, right, with an American film crew, right? Like, that's not easy to do. Like, we needed $2 million of insurance just to be allowed to film on a national park in Sydney. So we had to get our partners to create that safe space, legal space.
Yep.
But then Isabella did such a great job of helping them develop as a family, as a creative unit, both the crew, right, the nine women and the one guy, and then the family that she was filming on stage. So she let them spend time together to get to know each other.
You know, this is, I think, very profound what you just said, because I think we often think excellence can be reduced to a set of technical kind of competencies and achievements. Like, well, if we just check these boxes, it'll be excellent. But there's something way deeper and very mysterious about the quality of community out of which creation and production, even the technical stuff, happens in a different way when there's that level of trust and you've taken time for that. It's easy to skip that, but you made, and you and the director made time for that. That's really cool. Mm. All right. And step number two.
So the third stage is pre-production, right? When you
post-production.
Post-production. When you now have your footage and you have to live with it and you have to make it work. Huh. And you probably can't go back. And so that stage is really pushing them through multiple iterations. And I think the tendency, particularly maybe for this generation, is to think, well, I just did it and I just put it out there, so it's done.
Yeah.
And that's not how excellence works, right? Excellence is created through, I would say, sustained, helpful, constructive criticism. Huh. And so you give them really constructive, specific feedback and challenges to make it better. Huh. And you don't accept that first draft. And you say, well, that's a great start. Huh. Now let's make it better. And then they bring the second draft back, and it's like, that is better. Let's go to the third draft. Third draft might be worse than the second draft, but they're getting towards that final thing, which is that deeper space where they discover kind of the core of their movie.
Is there any moment you can remember that you could describe to us where you didn't settle? Like, there was something in an early cut that you decided, no, we can do that.
Well, there's that mysterious section of the flashbacks.
Yeah.
And how they're handled, and how many, and
right.
for how long, you know? And I mean, I think it'd be easy to overplay that and make it like a full scene and have dialogue. And it was like, no, just give us how it feels. Give us the impression of how those flashbacks just flash upon your face, right? So that editor, right? Editing, right? That is what we're talking about. We're talking about editing, right? Writing is rewriting, and filmmaking is editing.
So. It also occurs to me, we see those they flash by, but the directorial and writing work necessary to get all that B-roll, we might call it, but that's like not fair to call it that.
Right.
That was a huge amount of acting, of direction, invested in something that in the end is just a set of like momentary impressions that almost are too fleeting to fully grasp.
And you have to be willing to let that go. That we call it kill your darlings, right? The thing you're attached to, and just be like, no, they just need just a touch, not too much. So less in this case is much more.
I love how you've framed this. It's almost like you teach this or something. It's really quite remarkable. Because it seems so within the grasp of anyone in this room. When we were working with storytellers, creatives, designers of many kinds, raise the sense of possibility, make room for dreaming, create safety and permission to fail in the midst of production, and then just iterate relentlessly, asking how could this be better? I mean, we can all do that. We don't all have to be filmmakers. We don't all have to be writers or whatever, but we can all be part of doing that and making room then for someone to excel in the way that Isabella did. That is so beautiful, and thank you for sharing that.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Well, Romanita is going to join me, and she and I are going to have a conversation for this last half hour, spurred by your questions and comments. I'm so thrilled that we get to talk. So, yeah, that's it.
Thank you all so much for all of your questions. They were quite insightful and brought a lot of depth. We have tried our best to consolidate them, so I will just forewarn you now. If you don't hear your specific question, don't feel bad. We've tried to consolidate them. But the other thing is we may not get through every question because we did get a number of them.
However, I now have the ideas for my next 7 books, so that was helpful.
Well, there were a set of questions, Andy, related to your comments about charity and sacrifice, and a couple of nuances to it. One is I think people wanted to hear you just say a little bit more about the distinction.
Yes.
But I think in hearing about the distinction, they also want to hear a little bit more about how do they move their supporters forward towards sacrifice and their organizations.
Wow. Well, this is a really important topic and very close, I think, to the heart of the kind of missions we're trying to carry out. So let me begin by kind of underlying what I think is notable about vulnerability. I think it's about meaningful risk. So to be vulnerable is to have something really meaningful at stake that really could be lost. I think the problem with many kinds of charity, especially, and I realize I'm kind of choosing that word and assigning a lot of bad value to it. There's lots of good things that are done under the name of charity. But what it can mean is a form of helping, in quotes, that does not expose the helper to any meaningful risk. So at the most basic level, a money economy is actually designed to give you authority without vulnerability. So money is a way of arranging exchange of value without my having to pay attention to the relational risk I'd have to actually get something from someone in a non-financial way. So when I go into my local convenience store and I hand over money in exchange for Walker's shortbread, which is my personal addiction that I obtain at my convenience store, I don't have to know that other person. I don't walk in wondering, can I persuade them to give me my Walker's shortbread today? Oh, I've got money. They've got shortbread. There's no risk in this exchange. And money is actually something we created as human beings, as human civilizations, to lower the risk of interpersonal exchange, to allow us to have impersonal transactions at arm's length that don't implicate us in the risk of being human. And at its limit, money is liquid power. It's power that I can count, so I don't have the risk of not knowing how much I have. So most forms of power you can't count, and one of the basic risks of power is you never quite know how much you have. But with money, you know exactly how much. It's power that you can store. That is, I can decide to use it today, or I can decide to use it later. I have 30 minutes to use whatever power is left of, you know, my role as keynote speaker, and you have 30 minutes left as MC, and then we're done. It's over. But money, I can save for tomorrow. Now, that's reducing my risk. It's very risky to use it right now. What if I'd rather use it tomorrow? Money lets me do that. And then money, account, store, and exchange freely for other things. Most forms of power can only be exchanged for a few things, but money, you can get all kinds of things. So money is a way of lowering your risk as a human being. So the fundamental problem is that we have created the impression that the main thing people need is money, and so people with extra money should give their money. But this actually keeps us at very far removed relationally from the communities we hope that we're helping. And in fact, the greatest needs in those communities are not easily rendered as financial needs. And we all know this if we're expert practitioners in development, we know this, but our donors don't know it. And so just to be giving money is already to be distancing yourself. And then if the money you're giving is not a meaningful risk for you, if it makes no real dent, if it's just an act of kind of virtue signaling, you could call it, There's no risk. And I think that's always going to end up unintentionally increasing vulnerability at the other end of the system. Mm-hmm. Now, so I think the second part of the question would be,
how do we move ourselves in our organizations? And can I add something
I'd love to
respond to? When I was listening to you speak, the first thing I thought about is the way we get to sacrifice is through love. And yes. For some of the organizations that I've seen that do work in incredible places where you wouldn't expect people to be, it's one thing to have empathy for those that you serve. It's a very different thing to love them, because sacrifice out of guilt, which is what donors often hear and experience, is very different than sacrifice that comes from love and a place of solidarity.
Wow. So I think the work we have to do, and this is not easy, is establishing, the phrase that's coming to mind is chains of love, that is links of genuine, loving, mutually sacrificial relationships all the way down to the level of that local community. So I'm thinking about my friend Rudy Carrasco, who works in, Rudy,
yes,
I think,
yes.
Our mutual friend, who works in business development in the United States. And Rudy has relationships, and at one direct relationships, and then at one linkage away, with entrepreneurs in materially poor and in other ways underserved communities in the United States. There's all kinds of reasons that realistically I can't enter into a direct loving relationship with all those people.
Exactly.
But I do have a direct and deeply sacrificial relationship with Rudy that's built up, in our case, over decades of friendship. And because my wife and I just sent I don't like the way we don't talk about money. We sent a $2,600 gift, okay? So that's not huge in terms of what we could give, but it's not tiny, it wasn't just pocket change. And I don't like it that we conceal how much money we give. That seems like risk avoidance to me. So I always try to be just very concrete. So we sent $2,600 to Rudy's work through Partners Worldwide. Why? Not just in the hope that our money will do something good, but in the confidence that because it's linked by relationships of love with Rudy, with the implementing partners at the other end, ultimately with the kind of beneficiaries of all that love, that it will empower people rather than just alleviating our guilt or just doing something good for someone I don't have a relationship with. Now, how does that scale? Like, that's one of the big questions. I'm not sure. That might be an idolatrous question to ask. How does that scale? How do you scale love? Maybe the whole problem with our whole aid regime, in which we've sunk trillions of dollars into parts of the world with highly regularized systems, but without very much love, and has seemingly just disappeared like, you know, water onto parched sand. Maybe it's because we tried to scale something that is not easily scalable in the terms that we've set for ourselves.
Entirely possible, and I think a question we might have to ask ourselves is, how do we empower and enable people on the other end of our dollars, which gets into an entirely different question around the mechanisms and means of development, and how we do it, and how we empower people with our dollars to do it, and how we minister to the donors who give it so that they can support work in new ways.
Yes, exactly. And actually, inside the development organizations, I think there's already a lot of wisdom about this. Mm-hmm. The problem is changing the donor's own story of what's going on. Mm-hmm. There's an implicit story among middle-class, let's say, Americans about what they imagine is happening at the other end. And the need to triangulate between what we know really needs to happen and what the donor imagines happening is very taxing, right? So ultimately, it's about re-narrating for the donor what's going on. That's the very important storytelling work that needs to happen.
Right, and then how do we enlist donors in telling that story to other donors?
Yes, exactly.
How do we create linkages of love between them and community that changes the way the narrative is told and what's expected?
Yes.
Creating power where there is already power.
Yes, yes. Beautiful, beautiful. Wow.
Well, the second question, so we're skipping a little bit between your organization story questions and stories that we have about ourselves. One question is, most of us here are leaders in organizations. Please say more about the concept of hidden vulnerability.
Yes. So this is obviously from someone who's read my book, Strong and Weak, which is all about the 2x2 that I shared yesterday afternoon. And I actually think the most important chapter in that book is about what I call the drama of leadership. And the drama, so I presented yesterday the drama just of being human, this kind of basic tension or need to combine authority and vulnerability. But the drama of leadership is hidden vulnerability. It's that you are aware, intently aware, of risks to you personally, to the people you serve, to the organization you're leading, that others do not see. So you can be living 100% up and to the right on that graph. That is, you're taking proper authority and you're also taking proper risk. But the reality is the people you lead do not see you there. They see your authority. They do not see your vulnerability. So you can actually be living a flourishing life as a leader, but you'll be seen to some extent in more towards the upper left. And I mean, this happens in parenting, or especially when our children are young. Our children just instantly can see us as authority. They don't see all the vulnerability we bear. Now, parenting and family is so intense and so bound by love that I think it's less painful sometimes there. But in organizations where people will inevitably, it's not even that they assume, they just can't imagine what it's like to see all the vulnerabilities that you see as a leader. And you cannot tell them. Because why is that? Like, why shouldn't we all just share? Like, all be transparent. Wouldn't that be better, right?
Fantastic.
First of all, there are laws. We're not allowed to share some of these things. Like, literally, legally, we cannot disclose things. But the deeper reason below the law is that actually I think the job of a leader is to steward vulnerability that the organizations, and that if it were disclosed, would actually disempower and undermine the authority within the organization. So it's not that leaders should never disclose their own risks or organizational risks, but the disclosure always has to be linked to, do people have some capacity to meaningfully act in response to this? And if the answer is no, my disclosing this would expose people to a whole set of risks they haven't considered and that they cannot directly act on, it's just going to create chaos if you do that. Every morning, at least until the current presidency, it has begun with a briefing, since the Eisenhower years, begun with a briefing from whoever's in the kind of Director of National Intelligence role, at least that's the most recent name of the role, called the President's Daily Brief. And it's a summary of all the threats to the United States that have been uncovered by American intelligence in the previous 24 hours. It's the most highly classified document in the US government. Only one page has ever been made public. August 6, 2011, George W. Bush was briefed with a headline that said, Bin Laden determined to strike in U.S. That was August 6, 2001. And every morning, the president his schedule has started with that. Now, the president cannot go out and say, my fellow Americans, guess what I heard this morning? It would cause absolute chaos if we all knew what's in that brief every day. And instead, the president has to go out and do all kinds of routine functions, do all kinds of ceremonial things, try to advance a positive agenda, all the while bearing the awareness of the greatest threats that face the nation, some of which will come to pass, many of which will not. And the reason is, in order to actually release the authority that is present within the nation that will make it a stronger community and able to bear those threats. If you just disclose all the threats all at once, it's going to cause collapse of the system. So how you do that in a healthy way is the question of leadership, because most leaders do not manage to do this in a healthy way.
And that was going to be the thing that I was going to say, because my thought would be, but people need to see this vulnerability. And so talk a little bit about how leaders then authentically show themselves without creating these false narratives of vulnerability so that they can create the kind of bonding that teams need.
Oh, man. So there are some things that we, maybe the best answer is I don't entirely know, and I'm trying to figure this out every day in different contexts I'm in, as I'm sure you all are. And I have to say, the rules keep shifting on this, in that we use, in dominant culture in America, we used to value a kind of distance from leaders, and now we value a kind of transparency. I will also say the rules are different and complicatedly and in many ways unfairly different for men and for women, that there's different kind of rules of the game when women are in leadership than in men, so it's hard to generalize completely. But I think there are risks we can take every day that have tremendous symbolic value. And by symbol, I do not mean it's not real. I actually mean it's deeply real. That when I take those risks, and they don't involve disclosing things that I ought not disclose or that would implicate or somehow undermine others' authority, but there's ways, every day I have options to show up with kind of symbolic openness. I'm not content with that word because it sounds like it's merely symbolic. But no, it's making really clear choices. I'm not going to stay in a safety zone as a leader here. I'm going to actively extend myself. And leadership in the end has to be about symbolic action because there's only so many hours in the day. So you have to pick your moments really well. And the leaders I've seen and really admired, they are not willy-nilly disclosing. They're not just constantly venting. I mean, that's not a helpful leader at all. But they are continually, strategically in a way, choosing to open up things they would not have to, that their position could insulate them from having to deal with. And that makes them trustworthy on the things that they may not disclose. Does that make sense?
It makes complete sense. The thing that came to mind is there are ways for leaders to engage people in the principles that they are challenged by, in the underlying themes and the scope of what they're facing, without having to take people into the details. And sometimes, because as a leader, their work can be in these big decisions, you can get focused on people understanding that context when really they maybe need to actually understand the principles and things that are shaping and guiding the decisions. And there are other ways to communicate that without saying, got a note from Bin Laden about Bin Laden. He's coming, but there are ways to speak into the power of strength and national security and about the ability for us to come together and what it means for us to be a country that's strong in the face of challenges that are external. And translating that as a leader, I think, can be challenging.
Oh, that's really good. That there may be facts and circumstances that you can't disclose, but that doesn't mean you can't adjust. Like, a lot of leadership, right, is naming the vulnerabilities of the community in such a way that we can act on them. And that's what happens when you kind of find those principles or bigger frame in which people can act. That's really, really helpful.
And I think it empowers them to name their fear, which may be different than the leader's.
Ooh.
And there can be this assumption of, this is what I'm worried about, so it's what we're all worried about.
Yes.
And that's just not always the case, right?
Yes.
Wow.
And part of, just if I can add to that, part of why it's not my job as a leader, so I come into this very week, right, this time with you, with all kinds of vulnerabilities that that accompany me. I could enumerate them, but I'm not going to. Why? Because this is not about me. I'm not here as like a therapy session for my deepest fears. Actually, what is this kind of event about? It's about increasing your authority and increasing your vulnerability. And for me as a leader in the role that I'm playing or that we're playing here, our job is not to try to figure out how to manage our vulnerabilities in this moment. It's actually to attend to the vulnerabilities that come with the kind of leadership that's in the room. And so that's another reason that the leader has to be very careful about personal disclosure, because that crowds out attention to the actual agenda, which is not my, I have to find another place for that to be handled. But my job when I'm in that role is to think about the vulnerabilities of the people in the community that I'm leading.
Thank you. This next question, there were several questions and they related to a couple of different topics, but I think the underlying shared sort of overlap between them all was, we live in a world where the stories are disparate, and you alluded to this sort of how we've had this Exodus story. And, you know, so one of the questions was around the fact that, and for some people, that Exodus story didn't play out so well. And then another one was around, and there are a lot of different things where there are these competing narratives, and some narratives that are good for some people weren't good for other people.
Yes.
How do we manage that when we're living in a world with so many competing narratives, or narratives that if they're not competing, they're just not on the same plane, they're headed in a lot of different directions?
Wow.
Especially as we try to change the world, which was where a lot of the emphasis was at, and get people moving in a common direction.
Wow. So I think there have to be, I think there are two kinds of stories we tell. We tell stories about the past and we tell stories about the future. So where we've been and where we're going. And it seems to me we have to, let me try an etymology on here. I think we have to work harder at remembering. To remember, now, I don't have my Latin dictionary in front of me, but it's an interesting pairing of a prefix and a root. So the member root is actually about the members of the body, I think. And to remember is to reconsider or retell how different components or different parts of the story have happened, and to put them into one body. When you remember, you re-narrate in such a way that you put different pieces together. The stories we've told about our past are partial memories that have not included people who should be members of us, if this makes sense. I mean, I'm thinking about Romans 12 and how Paul talks about you're a body with all these different members, and you're going to have to consider one another's members as members. And just as when I have even the slightest sensation, especially of pain, let's say, in, you know, even in just one of my extremities, my whole body reacts, right? Paul says you need to rejoice when one member is rejoicing, but you also need to weep when another member is weeping. And I wonder if what we need are stories about the past that remember. Like, I just imagine the story that I inherited from my family and culture versus the story that you inherited. And honestly, my guess is that much of your story was not a member of the story I inherited.
Amen.
But as we start telling the story together, you become a member of my story. And there are ways, now there are ways to do it that are very conflictual and are kind of zero sum, and either your story wins or my story wins, but there's another way to do it that remembers it, and it becomes, we become members both of this story, with its tragedy and its beauty, with its moments of great hope and progress, with its moments of great disappointment. So that's one thing, I think remembering. And then we the only way to tell better stories for the future is to ask who's telling them. Who gets to be kind of in the room as we envision? And who is close enough to me that kind of their role in that template of subject and opponent and helper, like who are my helpers? Who do I see as the subject of the story? What's our goal? Who is our sender? I've got to have people in my community helping me tell that story of the future who have an accurate remembering. This is kind of abstract. So I don't know if it's helping, but I don't know any, I mean, you got to start like with the big picture, and it's, have I gone back and made you part of my story of my past? Mm-hmm. And now are we together constructing a story of the future? That's the only way I know how to do it.
Well, and it makes me think about one of the examples. So I'll kind of see if I'm tracking with what you're saying, be a proxy for the audience. Was talking about neighborhood change, which at its worst case, sometimes people call it gentrification and it's got a really negative sense, and at its other times it's called economic development and the neighborhood's getting better. And they were asking about these disparate stories, and the way I think about what you're saying is sometimes when we remember, we sort of assume that remembering doesn't come with the narrative of conflict.
Yes.
And so we don't know how to tell that story. And we assume that when we put all the pieces together, because we've been taught that you put a puzzle together and there's lots of great pictures, that everything just makes sense. And sometimes when we remember, and there are points of pain.
Wow.
And there are points and lines where things don't always look good. And I wonder if as leaders, when we're trying to lead our teams or go into communities and do that work, if sometimes we're remembering in a way that we think everything's going to be this beautiful puzzle that all makes sense, as opposed to have these points of pain that we have to attend to and recognize that they're there.
Wow. One of the most succinctly influential things I've ever heard was from Dr. John Perkins, who said, and I'm sure he said it in many places, but once in my hearing, America has never repented of slavery. He says, there's lots of other things you can feel about slavery, like we wish we hadn't done it, we're glad we don't do it anymore, you know, we know that we did it. Like, you could remember it in that kind of thin sense. But to repent of it, you can really make a case. There has been no process by which America as a civil society has ever said, we repent of it. And I wonder if the bridge, once we include the conflict in the remembering, then how in the world do we proceed? That's why we're afraid to put it in the picture. And the way is somehow to come to a point of repentance and forgiveness of one another, and then asking for God's forgiveness, and then you're able to tell a new story that's not based on some false harmony out of the past.
Love that. Thank you. My big takeaway from that is I like how you moved it forward to say not only do we recognize the places of pain, but then we can be called to take action.
Yes.
Two words that I heard once when I read a book that said, the only book I ever read, no, I'm joking. But a book I read that stuck out to me is it said, we have to be people who have epistemological humility, humility in our story, and ontological conviction. We can be convicted about the truth.
Oh,
and those two things are not separate. And I think what you're inviting us to is to do that and then to be propelled forward to take action in light of what we learn and see and hear when we remember,
which is beautiful.
Wow, beautiful. The last question that I think we've got time for here is a personal question that's related to how do we live out some of the things you talked about? And so this particular question I thought was a great one. How do I justify saving for retirement and other smart, in air quote, things that I do for me and my family that are specifically for the purpose of being less vulnerable, of reducing, of being safe and reducing my suffering? How do I do that in a way that is meaningful and in a way that lives into what you're saying? Where is the, I think people are saying, help us think about the balance.
Yeah. Why are we saving at all? Why put on your seatbelt, right? I mean, live a life of risk. I think it all, it really comes down to why are you saving? What is your imagined future? Is it a future of less risk? Or is it actually, I'm saving so that I will be able, over the course of my life, to take more and more meaningful risk? And this is the way my family views, we do save on various time horizons. And the reason we do is we believe God's going to call us to take risks in the future. And I think what the quality of money that allows us to defer action, to defer power, that we are attempting to position ourselves to be more available for the mission of God than we are now, with certain kinds of resources that unlock the ability to take lots of meaningful risk. There's no problem in reducing meaningless risk. So I define vulnerability as meaningful risk. There's lots of risks. The risk that I'll go out and get in my Uber this afternoon to visit my friends and not put on my seatbelt and a car accident happens. And if I could have put on that seatbelt and reduced that risk, I absolutely should, because there is no meaning in an unfortunate accident happening while I'm in my car. On the other hand, I mentioned being in the nation of Haiti with Dr. Brendan Salter McNeil a couple years ago. I've been there several times, and many times, as you know, when you're in Haiti, there are no seatbelts, right? So something that makes no sense to do here in the United States, I've done many times in Haiti. Why? Because it's part of a bigger story. I don't go to Haiti to live seatbeltless, but I go and I take the meaningful risk of getting in vehicles that don't really have great protection for their occupants because there's some deeper story I'm part of. And I actually see my savings and various other kinds of resources that might accumulate in my name, they're available to be put at risk in deeper ways in the future. And if that's what you're doing with your savings, you're actually preparing yourself for a life of flourishing all the way along, rather than a life that withdraws into safety at some point and says, well, I think I've had enough risk. Thank you very much. That being said, we may have given people enough risk for this day. And I just want to say thank you so much for the invitation to be here and for this whole group. And thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Andy.